A bump in the road? The wardrobe incident. Though rock solid at its core, Conley's story was yet frayed around the edges. Critics charge that he seemed to forget some important points and that he evaded others. They target an odd element of his testimony that has come to be known as the wardrobe incident, which he says occurred in Frank's office after returning from moving the body of Mary Fagan to the basement. Conley's accusers and critics use the episode to invalidate his timeline and as proof that his entire testimony is an elaborate invention. It is the only section that seems to be impeached by the testimony of the women involved. Here is how Conley described it on the witness stand. Quote, "And all at once he," end quote, "Frank," quote, "happened to look out of the door and there was somebody coming. And he said, 'My God, here is Emma Clark and Corinthia Hall.' And he said, 'Come over here, Jim. I've got to put you in this wardrobe.'" End quote. Large wood cabinet. Quote, "And he put me in this wardrobe, and I stayed there a good while, and they come in there, and I heard them go out, and Mr. Frank come there and said, 'You were in a tight place.' And I said, 'Yes.' And he said, 'You done very well.' So after they went out, and he had stepped in the hall and had come back, he let me out of the wardrobe. And he said, 'You sit down.' And I went and sat down, and Mr. Frank sat down." End quote. What's interesting about this portion of Conley's narrative is that it is entirely unnecessary to the storyline of the murder. If it were not included, it would have no effect, positive or negative, on the murder timeline. Yet Conley includes the episode in two of his four affidavits and in his court testimony. By Conley's timeline, this occurred after the murder, but the women he named, Emma Clark and Corinthia Hall, clearly had arrived and departed well before Mary Fagan arrived at the factory. It is an odd feature of his story, if only because it presents an easy opportunity for exposure, a true gotcha moment. Certainly, if Conley were trained or prepped by the police and prosecutors to give his testimony, as has been charged, this portion would never have been included in an otherwise convincing story. So why did Conley continue to repeat this, quote, "wardrobe incident," end quote, whenever he spoke of the case? If one follows Conley's description, he and Frank had just returned to Frank's second floor office after concealing the body in the basement. Frank, at that moment, would have understood that the only living witness to his crime was, quote, "the Negro Conley," end quote. In his panicked assessment, could Frank have understood what any murder mystery reader understands? That to escape undetected, all witnesses must be silenced or even killed? Although he vacillates slightly on what exactly he heard, in none of Conley's accounts does he ever claim to have ever seen the two visitors. He is reacting only to Frank's claim that they were approaching. He then gets in the cabinet and is left in an extremely uncomfortable, hot and sweating condition. And because of the wardrobe's latch mechanism, Conley is able to escape its coffin-like confines only when Frank lets him out. While locked in the wardrobe, Conley said, he could not hear the women talking and surmises that Frank must have taken them to an upper floor. In Conley's third sworn affidavit to police on May 28, 1913, he remembers the incident, but this time he says, quote, "I just heard Miss Emma say, 'Good morning, Mr. Frank, are you alone?' And Mr. Frank said, 'Yes,'" end quote. But Conley immediately follows that claim with an apparent contradiction about what he had actually heard. Quote, "And I couldn't hear them say nothing else, but I didn't know it was Miss Corinthia Hall until Mr. Frank spoke and said it was. But I heard Miss Emma's voice. They didn't stay there long until they were gone. I didn't hear them. I couldn't hear them talking. Only I heard Miss Emma say good morning. If they had been talking loud, I could have heard them, but if they were talking low, I couldn't." End quote. emphasis hours. Though he insists that the wardrobe incident occurred, Conley is less confident about what exactly he heard while locked in the cabinet. Did Frank say that he saw the two women approaching to trick Conley into jumping, willingly, into his own grave? Conley himself seems conflicted about that aspect of the murder case. Could it have been Leo Frank pretending to be speaking with the women and answering aloud as if he were having a conversation with them? Could Frank have been feminizing his voice and mimicking the women's earlier morning visit? Policeman W.W. Rogers did report that Frank's voice sounded, quote, ladylike, end quote. Quote, somewhat like a woman's, end quote. At the time of this incident, Mrs. White had already left for the day and had seen Conley on her way down the front stairs. She believed it to be about 12:50. Frank's own testimony confirms that his whole purpose in asking her to leave was to lock the factory building's outside door. So a surprise entry by Hall and Clark, as claimed by Frank, would have been impossible. This feigned visit is possibly the very moment when Frank considered the desperate choices he faced. If he carried the scheme through and suffocated Conley, how would he dispose of that body? Fagan's body was so awkwardly heavy that it required two men to move it, and Conley's would be considerably heavier for the slightly built superintendent to handle alone. How would he explain the disappearance of two people on his watch? What if Conley figured out his boss's plan and broke out of the cabinet? Was Conley describing the wardrobe incident in this interview with a Constitution reporter? Quote, I didn't get scared of Mr. Frank but once, and I don't want to tell what caused me to be afraid then. I went on ahead with the body like he told me to, 'cause I had been drinking and wasn't exactly in my right mind. Mr. Frank's looks kinder scared me, though, 'cause he looked just for the world like somebody that was crazy. I never saw a man look like he did, and I never want to see another look like that again. End quote. The panicked calculations of a frantic murderer probably prompted Frank to think of a better option: bribe Conley into silence, and pin the one body on the unsuspecting watchman Newt Lee, due at the factory later that evening. The murder notes, bribery, and burning the body. After recounting the wardrobe incident, Conley then described how the handwritten notes found next to Mary Fagan's body were created. Quote, and then, end quote, Frank, quote, said, can you write? And I said, yes, sir, a little bit. And he'd taken his pencil to fix up some notes. I was willing to do anything to help Mr. Frank because he was a white man and my superintendent. And he sat down and I sat down at the table, and Mr. Frank dictated the notes to me. Whatever it was, it didn't seem to suit him, and he told me to turn over and write again. And I turned the paper and wrote again, and when I done that, he told me to turn over again, and I turned over again and wrote on the next page there. And he looked at that and kind of liked it, and he said that was all right. Then he reached over and got another piece of paper, a green piece, and told me what to write. He took it and laid it on his desk and looked at me smiling and rubbing his hands, and then he pulled out a nice little roll of greenbacks and he said, here is $200. And I taken the money and looked at it a little bit and I said, Mr. Frank, don't you pay another dollar for that watchman. End quote. Jeweler, quote, because I will pay him myself. And he said, all right. I don't see what you want to buy a watch for either. That big fat wife of mine wanted me to buy an automobile, and I wouldn't do it. End quote. Two of the four notes Conley said he composed were found next to the body of Mary Fagan, and they appear to have been intended to place the blame for the crime on the Black Night Watchman. Frank then ordered that Conley burn Mary Fagan's body. Quote, and after a while, Mr. Frank looked at me and said, you go down there in the basement and you take a lot of trash and burn that package that's in front of the furnace. And I told him, all right. but I was afraid to go down there by myself, and Mr. Frank wouldn't go down there with me. He said, "There's no need of my going down there." And I said, "Mr. Frank, you are a white man and you done it, and I am not going down there and burn that myself." He looked at me then, kind of frightened, and he said, "Let me see that money." And he took the money back and put it back in his pocket. And I said, "Is this the way you do things?" And he said, "You keep your mouth shut. That is all right." And Mr. Frank turned around in his chair and looked at the money, and he looked back at me and folded his hands and looked up and said, "Why should I hang? I have wealthy people in Brooklyn." And he looked down when he said that, and I looked up at him, and he was looking up at the ceiling, and I said, "Mr. Frank, what about me?" And he said, "That's all right. Don't you worry about this thing. You just come back to work Monday like you don't know anything and keep your mouth shut. If you get caught, I will get you out on bond and send you away." And he said, "Can you come back this evening and do it?" And I said, "Yes, that I was coming to get my money." He said, "Well, I am going home to get dinner, and you come back here in about 40 minutes, and I will fix the money." And I said, "How will I get in?" And he said, "There will be a place for you to get in, all right, but if you are not coming back, let me know, and I will take those things," end quote, "murder notes," quote, "and put them down with the body." And I said, "All right, I will be back in about 40 minutes," end quote. Conley said he then left the factory and went to a bar, had a beer with a patron, interacted with several people, and went home and slept until 6:30 that evening. Conley then explained his first subsequent rendezvous with Frank 3 days later at the factory. Quote, "I saw him next time on Tuesday on the fourth floor when I was sweeping. He walked up and he said, 'Now remember, keep your mouth shut.' And I said, 'All right.' And he said, 'If you'd come back on Saturday and done what I told you to do with it down there, there wouldn't have been no trouble.'" End quote. Leo Frank's sexual catastrophe. Quote, "Frank had about as much chance as crippled grasshoppers in a pen of doves." End quote. Luther Z. Rosser. To the courtroom observers and the jury of 12 men, Conley's story finally made sense of the murder and severely restricted the defense's courtroom options. To effectively refute any of Conley's story would require that Leo Frank himself be placed on the stand, since nearly all of what Conley described took place in Frank's presence. The risk was obvious. It would open Frank up to the kind of blistering cross-examination under oath that he and his attorneys had been assiduously avoiding. If Frank refused to confront, quote, "the Negro Conley," end quote, in a jailhouse, even with his lawyer present, he certainly wanted no part of the state's top prosecutors confronting him in open court with a long, long list of unexplained facts and behaviors. That placed Leo Frank's defenders in a position where they had to de-emphasize the details, promote Frank's superior social standing, and appeal to the 12 white jurors on the basis of that holiest of holy American traditions, white supremacy. There was no one better prepared for that task than Georgia's own legal legend, Luther Z. Rosser. When Rosser sidled up to his black prey, Leo Frank and his supporters prayed that it was only a matter of time before Conley collapsed under the anticipated battering. Rosser eased into his task with a preliminary spelling test to showcase Conley's intellectual deficiencies. Question: "Can you read newspapers?" Answer: "Not much. I read them some." Question: "Do you read them often?" Answer: "I pick them up now and then." Question: "What do you read?" Answer: "Little words like this and that." Question: "They are pretty common words in the newspapers, aren't they?" Answer. Yes. Question. Can you spell school? Answer. Yes. Question. Color? Answer. No. Question. Shirt? Answer. Yes. Question. Cat? Answer. Yes. Question. Do you spell it with a K or with a C? Answer. With a K. Question. Can you spell mother? Answer. No. Question. Can you spell papa? Answer. Yes. Question. How? Answer. P-A-P-A. Question. Can you spell day? Answer. Yes. Question. Daylight? Answer. Yes. Question. Can you spell beer? Answer. Yes. Question. Can you spell whiskey? Answer. No. Question. Look at this picture and tell me if you can read any of these words. Answer. No. Question. Do you know your figures? Answer. Yes. Question. You know a good deal more about figures than you do about spelling, don't you? Answer. Yes. I can count better than I can spell. Question. Then you are better at figuring than you are at writing? Answer. Yes, I am better at counting. Question. Well, isn't figuring counting? Answer. I don't know. Question. You don't know you are 27 years old, do you, Jem? Answer. Yes, sir, that's what my mother said. The Atlanta Constitution's courtroom reporter described the scene. Quote, Jim's face showed that he could not see what in the world a great big white man with the knowledge of Luther Rosser could want to take up the time in court to go into a spelling bee with him for. The white man and the darkie had reached a perfect understanding, such as a white man and a Negro have when they are raised together on the same big plantation. End quote. But that was as far as Rosser was able to, quote, break down, end quote, the witness. Conley's vocabulary may have been limited, but his powers of recall were exceptional, and his account of the murder remained unshaken. He soon forced Rosser into an agitated retreat. The defense attorney made a mystifying series of blunders that would place his client deeper and deeper in irreversible legal jeopardy. Rosser's line of questioning focused the witness on the role he had claimed to play as, quote, lookout, end quote, while Frank committed infidelities at the factory. And to everyone's astonishment, Rosser walked Conley directly into revealing the most damaging aspects of Leo Frank's character. He asked his witness, quote, about the next time, end quote, you watched for Frank? Quote, what time of day? End quote. Quote, did you inquire who? End quote. The woman, quote, was? End quote. Quote, the next time was Thanksgiving, wasn't it? End quote. Quote, where were you when she arrived? End quote. Quote, what time did the woman come? End quote. Quote, did you know her? End quote. Atlanta stood aghast at the spectacle as Conley used every opening to relay in mortifying detail five other instances when he had acted as Frank's lookout while Frank engaged in sexual misconduct with women other than his wife. The Atlanta Constitution's court reporter seemed bewildered by the famed lawyer's tactic. Quote, he was apparently helping Jim Conley to tell all the damaging evidence he knew on the man whom he accuses of the horrible crime. End quote. And just as the prosecutors had hoped, Conley uncovered a pattern of planned sexual misbehavior by Frank at the factory that made the state's premeditated liaison motive far more plausible in the jurors' minds. After the noon recess, the judge felt that the testimony was of such a sleazy nature that he cleared the courtroom of all 150 women and teenagers. Conley proceeded to describe sexual acts he had witnessed while being Leo Frank's lookout. Frank said, quote, "Of course, you know I ain't built like other men." The reason he said that was, "I had seen him in a position I haven't seen any other man that has got children. I have seen him in the office two or three times before Thanksgiving, and a lady was in his office, and she was sitting down in a chair. And she had her clothes up to here, and he was down on his knees, and she had her hands on Mr. Frank. I have seen him another time there in the packing room with a young lady lying on the table. She was on the edge of the table when I saw her." End quote. Conley impressively one-upped the mighty barrister at every turn, and in one instance entirely turned the tables on him. When asked about one of Frank's, quote, "chatting," end quote, partners, quote, "Do you know who she was?" end quote, Conley rejoined, quote, "I don't know her name, but I know her face, and I know where she lives," end quote. Rosser should have been seeking just such an opportunity to trap Conley in a lie. Instead, Rosser beat a fast retreat and changed the subject. It had to be a telling moment for the jury. With Frank's dirty laundry thoroughly aired, Conley was yet able to establish another extremely damaging fact through the bungling barrister Luther Z. Rosser. He asked Conley a simple question. Quote, "Did you know old man Newtley?" End quote. Conley, quote, "No, I didn't know Newtley. I heard them say there was a Negro night watchman, but I never did know that he was a Negro." End quote. And with that brow-raising statement, the jury was now free to consider Leo Frank the lone guilty party. For how could Conley have written murder notes describing a man he had never seen? The notes describe the lone murderer as the, quote, "long, tall, Negro, black, night witch," end quote, which even Newt Lee took to mean night watch, and believed to be physically describing him. Frank knew them both, knew their work schedules, and could physically describe them both. Knowledge required in order for the murder note's message to be believed. Had Rosser not asked this question of Conley, the assumption that the small group of black employees at the factory all knew one another would have been left undisturbed in the minds of the jury. And with that, Rosser again outwitted himself and pushed his client ever closer to the gallows. But that was not the worst of it. With the murder schematically illustrated for the jurors, Prosecutor Dorsey moved quickly to undergird his, quote, "Negro testimony," end quote, with the requisite white support. No sooner did Conley leave the witness stand than a procession of Frank's white female employees testified about their negative personal encounters with their boss, a man they all agreed was possessed of a, quote, "bad character," end quote. And they were as forceful as Conley in their allegations, which seemed to verify the persistent rumor that, quote, "there was a brothel operating in the basement of the factory," end quote. Frank's lawyers did manage to gain a favorable ruling from Judge Roan that limited the scope and effect of the women's courtroom testimonies, but many of them elaborated unhesitatingly to investigators and to the press before and after the trial. When she tried to visit her sister-in-law at the factory and obtain her pay, Nellie Pettis testified that Frank, quote, "told me I couldn't see her until I saw him first," end quote. She told how Frank had leered at her, winked at her, pulled a box of money from his desk, and finally asked, quote, "what about it?" end quote. She left his office and his employ, telling Frank to, quote, "go to hell," end quote. As it had with Mary Fagan, this incident occurred when Pettis was seeking wages, suggesting that Frank saw the weekly payday routine as an opportunity to pressure the young girls into sexual encounters. Later, Frank's detectives and lawyers pushed Pettis to change her testimony, but she refused. And the charges were unrelenting, and all came, significantly, from white Southern girls about the same age and social class as the murder victim. Myrtice Cato swore that she had seen Frank and factory employee Rebecca Carson repeatedly go into the ladies' dressing room and remain there for 15 or 20 minutes. She concluded with a foreboding, quote, "That ain't all I know, and that ain't all I saw either," end quote. Maggie Nash, formerly Griffin, confirmed Cato's story and later swore that one of Frank's hired agents had pressured her to retract her negative assessment of Frank. She told the man he might try 100 years, but she would never do it. Former employee Dewey Hewell traveled from Cincinnati to testify. Quote, "I have seen Mr. Frank talk to Mary Fagan two or three times a day," end quote. Even putting, quote, "his hand on her shoulder," end quote, and calling her, quote, "Mary," end quote. Mamie Edmonds, formerly Kitchens, quote, "I was in the dressing room with Miss Irene Jackson when she was undressed. Mr. Frank opened the door, stuck his head inside. He did not knock. He just stood there and laughed. Miss Jackson said, 'Well, we are dressing, blame it.' And then he shut the door," end quote. Nellie Wood said at the coroner's inquest that Frank had made an indecent proposal to her. Quote, "He said, 'You know, I am not like other men.' And drawing his chair closer up to me, says, 'I don't think you understand me,' and put his hands on me. And I resisted and got up and opened the door," end quote. Under questioning at the coroner's hearing, she went further. Question: "Do you know Leo Frank?" Answer: "I worked for him 2 days." Question: "Did you observe any misconduct on his part?" Answer: "Well, his actions didn't suit me. He'd come around and put his hands on me when such conduct was entirely uncalled for." Question: "Is that all he did?" Answer: "No. He asked me one day to come into his office, saying that he wanted to talk to me. He tried to close the door, but I wouldn't let him. He got too familiar by getting so close to me. He also put his hands on me." Question: "Where did he put his hands?" Answer: "He barely touched my breast. He was subtle with his approaches and tried to pretend that he was joking, but I was too wary for such as that." Question: "Did he try further familiarities?" Answer: "Yes." Question: "When did this happen?" Answer: 2 years ago." Question: "What did you tell him when you left his employ?" Answer: "I just quit, telling him that it didn't suit me." Former factory employee Thomas Blackstock had witnessed Frank, quote, "picking on," end quote, factory girls a half dozen times and had heard other complaints around the factory. Ruth Robinson, who had known Mary Fagan as a little girl, testified, quote, "Mary had worked there a good long time and understood her business. Sometimes Frank would remain at Mary's machine 15 or 20 minutes. I never saw him show that much attention to the work of the other girls on that floor. I have seen Frank, in showing Mary about her work, take hold of her hands and hold them. Frank's visits to Mary and talks with her and assistance given her became more and more frequent. The very last day I worked there, I saw Frank talking to Mary. I heard him call her Mary," end quote. She further testified that, quote, "Frank undertook to give me $7 when he knew I was not entitled to the money, and he endeavored to have an assignation with me sometime the next week. This occurred in his office," end quote. The Constitution characterized the testimony of 16-year-old Will E. Turner. Quote, "He had seen Frank in conversation with Mary Fagan in the metal room. that the girl was retreating from Frank and Frank was following her. Frank had said, according to the witness, that he was the superintendent of the factory and wanted to talk to her. The girl had replied that she had some work to do and retreated from him. End quote. With every witness, Frank's initial claim not to know Mary Fagan seemed more and more like the evasions of a guilty man. Mertes Cato, Maggie Griffin, C.D. Donegan, H.R. Johnson, Marie Karst, Nellie Pettis, Mary Davis, Mary E. Wallace, Estelle Winkle, Carrie Smith. All witnesses for the defendant swore similarly, quote, that Leo M. Frank's character for lasciviousness was bad, end quote. Mary's older sister, Ollie, reported to the Pinkertons what Mary had confided to her. Quote, Mary had told her about watching the men and women employees at the pencil factory during the dinner hour, and stated that Mary had seen men and women hugging and kissing each other in the factory, and that couples would try to hide themselves behind boxes, and that Mary had looked through cracks and had seen couples committing fornication, and had told her about it on several different occasions. End quote. A friend of Mary Fagan's named George Epps told investigators that Mary had expressed to him her fears of Frank's improper advances. Mary's stepfather, J.W. Coleman, revealed, Mary, quote, had often said that things went on at the factory that were not nice, and that some of the people there tried to get fresh. She told most of those stories to her mother, end quote. 13-year-old Grace Hicks claimed that Mary had complained to her that Leo M. Frank had put his arm around her and asked Mary if she wanted to take a joy ride of heaven, and that Mary Fagan had asked Frank, how? To which Frank replied that he would show her someday. Two men, a Grady Kennington and a Mr. V. F. Shank, claimed that they often saw men and women going into the pencil factory after dark. A man named Mendenhall said that he had heard from a few men working at the factory about, quote, several, end quote, girl employees that Frank had been, quote, familiar with, end quote, but, quote, they were afraid to testify against Mr. Frank, end quote. Former employee Paul Whitaker told investigators that he often noticed that when Frank was talking to female employees, quote, it seemed to me that, end quote, Frank, quote, rubbed up against them a little too much, end quote. A white man named C. Brutus Dalton came forward and testified in support of Conley's story, claiming that he was Frank's co-conspirator in the sexual goings-on at the factory. Under oath, he said, quote, I have, on several visits to Leo M. Frank's office, seen Frank with girls in his office, and I have seen Frank play with them, hug them, kiss them, and pinch them. I saw Frank on two or three occasions take a girl and go to the back of the room where the dressing room is. On one occasion, Frank had 6 bottles of beer and I carried 3 more bottles to his office. In regard to the cot in the basement, I know that Leo Frank knew about it because I have heard him speak of it. Conley was sitting at the front door. End quote. He said that a former pencil factory worker named Daisy Hopkins had introduced him to Leo Frank, and that they all had engaged in immoral behavior. Intending no pun at all, the Constitution called Dalton's testimony, quote, remarkably frank, end quote. Not all of these unseemly revelations spilled out in the trial, but enough had been disclosed before trial to make the summer of 1913 an extremely hot one for Leo Frank. Despite what appeared to be an insurmountable wall of evidence that supported the testimony of Jim Conley, Frank nevertheless had reason to feel hopeful. If it could be shown that the testimony of the young girls was in some way corrupted or coached, the charge of sexual deviancy could be shown to be mere vilification. Certainly, Luther Rosser and Reuben Arnold, two of the greatest cross-examiners in the South, would let none of the alleged seedy pencil factory sexcapades go unanswered. But when their chance came to have at the young women to redeem their client's character, they simply let all the accusations ride unchallenged. Quote, Frank's lawyers sat on their hands, end quote, wrote Steve Oney, leaving their client naked in front of an utterly dumbfounded jury. Their silence on this most pivotal issue, an issue Frank's attorneys themselves opened up for the court's consideration, could only be taken as verification of the worst of Frank's behavior. The defense's only response to the veritable mudslide was to move to have all such testimony stricken from the record. Said Rosser, quote, the fact that Frank might have been frequently guilty of immorality could not be held against him, end quote, or held, quote, as evidence of bad character and reputation. Lasciviousness is not one of the character traits involved in a case of murder, end quote. And with that, Frank's attorneys conceded that their client had engaged in sexually deviant behavior. Dorsey's promise to present, quote, a fearful mass of testimony to prove the perversion of the accused, end quote, forced Frank's lawyers into full retreat. Reuben Arnold sheepishly argued to the jury, quote, we are not trying this case on whether you or I or Frank had been perfect in the past. Let him who is without sin cast the first stone. End quote. Furthermore, he said, Frank's behavior was a sign that we are getting more broad-minded. Deliver me from one of these prudish fellows that never looks at a girl and never puts his hands on her. He's the kind that I wouldn't trust behind the door. The lack of any refutation of these white women's testimonies further sensationalized the trial and kept it focused on the sexual nature of the crime. Worse for the defendant, the flood of charges of inappropriate sexual conduct all had been directed at Frank, and none at Conley, or Newt Lee, or any of the other black employees. And Frank's own hired detectives, the Pinkertons, specifically included in their report that, quote, Mary Fagan had never mentioned any of the Negro employees at the factory being familiar towards her or taking any liberties, end quote. More charges surface. Other allegations had surfaced that did not make it to trial, but nonetheless circulated widely. A white rooming house owner named Nina Formby came forward and swore that Frank was a regular customer of hers and that he had called her several times on the night of the murder in a panicked state, seeking a private place for something she knew not what. She claimed in her affidavit and in interviews that Frank even threatened her life when she refused to assist him. She later recanted the story in the press, purportedly claiming that police had, quote, browbeaten, end quote, her, and, quote, plied her with whiskey, end quote, until she agreed to this story. But Formby's original affidavit seemed far too detailed to be entirely concocted, and Chief Lanford strongly suggested that he had corroborating evidence from the telephone company's switchboard operators on duty that night. The Washington Post reported that Formby, quote, charged that friends of Frank offered her a large sum to leave Atlanta. She said that when she refused the money, threats were made, end quote. And on the same day Formby came forward, a, quote, special policeman, end quote, Robert P. House, positively identified Leo Frank as the man he had previously apprehended in the woods with a young girl, intent on an, quote, immoral purpose, end quote. He said that he had, quote, frequently, end quote, seen Frank entering the private wooded area with a young girl, and this particular time he followed him to a, quote, swampy section, concealed from view by trees and shrubbery, end quote. The Frank team was overwhelmed by and ill-equipped to deal with the prosecution's exposure of Frank's hidden lifestyle. If race is the central fixation of Southern white society, sex is a very close second. As more and more of the clandestine sexual aspects of Frank's life were revealed, it seemed certain that if not murder, Frank had committed yet another serious Georgia crime, sodomy, which at that time carried a penalty of life imprisonment. Obviously, this compounded the challenges facing Frank's legal team. Be with us again next time when we present the next chapter of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. Published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam.